Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. The Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we've got Coming Around again with Billboard.com Senior Associate Editor Andrew Unterberger. Andrew will be chatting with Billboard's Senior Editor Frank DiGiacomo about the 40th anniversary of Billy Joel's The Stranger. The guys talk about how the album that turned Billy Joel into a superstar is practically a greatest hit set into itself, and how the album and Billy have outlived the critics that disparaged it at the time. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or review while you're at it. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit itunes.com/billboardpodcasts. So, before we get into the show, did you know Billy Joel's The Stranger generated 4 top 40 charting singles on the Billboard Hot 100, including his first top 10 hit, Just the Way You Are? The song hit number 3 in February of 1978 and was followed by 3 further top 40 hits: Movin' Out, Only the Good Die Young, and She's Always a Woman. As for the album, it was a chart monster, giving Joel his first top 10 effort, peaking at number 2 on the Billboard 200 chart. It spent 6 weeks stuck in the runner-up slot, trapped behind the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, which actually racked up 24 weeks at number 1. So now, let's head back to 1977 with Billy Joel's The Stranger on Coming Around Again. I've been working too hard to give you a heart attack. You want to know by now. Who needs a house out in Hackensack?
Hello, and welcome to Coming Around Again, Billboard's anniversary theme podcast celebrating anniversaries in the music world. Today we're talking about Billy Joel's The Stranger album, which turns 40 as of Friday, September 29th. So it's an interesting album, and here to talk about it with us, we got Billboard Senior Editor Frank DiGiacomo. How's it going, Frank?
All right, Andrew. How are you? Thanks for having me here.
All right, and thanks for coming on. Now, I feel like when I asked you to be on this podcast, like, you were ready for it. Like, you were, I asked if you were a Billy Joel guy. Had a pretty good idea that you were, but your response was pretty immediate, and you were just telling me just now that you actually saw Billy on the tour for this album.
Yeah, it's funny. He was one of the first concerts I went to. I mean, I think the very first was Jefferson Starship, but then when The Stranger came out, it was just a huge album. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, and it was a huge album there. And even before then, Piano Man and Captain Jack were just staples of FM radio,
sure,
and two of my favorite songs. And so when I heard The Stranger, I just fell in love with that album and managed to find some friends who of driving age who took me to see the show. So it was a great show. He that was the thing. He's such an amazing live act. Then I saw him again for the 52nd Street tour, and then there was a tour in between that and Glass Houses, and I saw him those 3 times.
So I mean, personally, like, growing up in the suburbs of Philly and kind of spending a lot of time around the New York tri-state area, like, Billy Joel is about as big of an institution as it gets,
right?
At least for the kind of the white suburban set. But did that also kind of translate to Youngstown, Ohio? Like, you go there, does everybody know like all the words to all the songs on the album?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's interesting because for me, Billy Joel's like, he's this guy who, I guess, he was born in the Bronx but then lived in Levittown.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's kind of got this combination of sort of urban attitude but then suburban disillusionment.
Yeah.
And that was very Youngstown at the time because it was – and so I think he really spoke to a lot of the people where I lived, a lot of the guys, especially guys my age who were in high school.
And so you talked about how, you already had a couple favorite songs of his and a couple songs that were big on radio. So the album before this, and just to give a little background, the album before this was Turnstiles in 1976. Probably, I would say it's one of his best albums. I would say that it has in like a number of the songs I would consider favorites and songs that have sort of endured as Billy Joel's kind of standards. It's got New York State of Mind, which is probably one of the 5 most famous songs about New York ever. We were just talking about Miami 2017, which he still starts shows with all the time. Say Goodbye to Hollywood. A number of like really, really recognizable songs. Would you like to take a guess where that album peaked on the Billboard 200 chart?
Wow. I'm guessing that it probably didn't do well at all, because I do remember he was kind of struggling as an artist. So I'm going to say it hit 30.
Number 122.
Oh, geez.
So, like, this kind of took me aback when I was doing some research for this. Like, as you mentioned, Piano Man was obviously, that was a top 40 hit.
Right.
It's probably the first Billy Joel song that a lot of people knew. And he had other songs that kind of made it onto FM radio. And, you know, he had success. He was a successful touring musician. He broke even. But he wasn't a star, like, yeah, by any means. And he was actually on kind of a cold streak coming into The Stranger, which is sort of, it's sort of surprising to think about, especially considering how many of those songs from his mid-70s have gone on to be kind of considered classics, and considering just how monstrously successful The Stranger was. Like, it you know, went diamond eventually. It became the best-selling album in Columbia Records history. It basically made him a superstar, and that was him for the rest of his life.
Right.
40 years later, he's still on that level, never really fell off. If you could kind of, like, crystallize it in one sort of main point or main difference about this album, what was it about this album that you think took him to that, like out of the doldrums and into that kind of almost superstar class?
It's interesting. I mean, I just feel like he kind of, for me, a lot of it is, if, I don't know, this may be a weird thing, but it's like if Frank Sinatra had successfully done a rock album, like, there's this,
okay,
it just gels in a way that it's, there's something timeless about the music. And the other thing about Billy Joel that I think is great, and why this album works better than, say, the last one, is there's storytelling going on in this, mm-hmm, album that was on the Piano Man album, but then I think he kind of moved away from a little bit, or
okay, yeah,
it was a little abstract. I mean,
Miami, it feels kind of thematically connected on this album,
right,
to a certain extent.
Exactly. And, you know, it really captured, I think, the sort of zeitgeist of the 70s, where people were sort of struggling with this kind of, like, I'm killing myself for what? Like,
right,
you know, moving out is such a great look at being a middle-class driver, I think.
Yeah, and you see that in a couple of kind of various spots throughout the album where, you know, Brenda and Eddie, and they're like Sears furniture, and
right,
the scenes from Italian restaurant, and just the entire story of Vienna basically is like saying, hey, just like kind of chill. Like, you don't need to,
exactly,
to better yourself so dramatically so quickly. And how much it, so I mean, that's obviously a big part of it, is that he, you know, he kind of, I don't know if he improved as a storyteller, but he sort of focused as a storyteller. And he also started working with the guy who was going to basically help define his albums from there on, and from a sonic perspective, and that's Phil Ramone.
Phil Ramone, right.
What do you see as, what Phil Ramone kind of either added to Billy Joel's, like, you know, sonic palette, or just how he focused him? Like, how do you think that collaboration ended up paying off?
Well, I remember reading Phil Ramone having this sort of, I think he called it like the no bullshit agreement with the musicians, and it was like they just were very honest to each other about songs. Mm-hmm. I also think that Billy was very adamant about using the musicians that he played live with.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that makes him such a great artist too, is that the music sounds great and live, and Phil Ramone was into that.
Yeah, one of the interesting kind of what-if stories about this album is that, like, apparently he was originally supposed to record it with George Martin, the Beatles producer.
Right, I've read that.
But George Martin didn't want to use his band.
Yeah.
And, you know, Billy Joel is as big of a Beatlemaniac as it comes, but he said, no, that's a deal-breaker for me. Like, if I can't play with my band, you know, it's just not going to work out. And apparently, like, after the tremendous success of The Stranger, George Martin writes him a letter saying, like, hey, you were right.
Yeah. Have you ever seen photos of Billy Joel, like, as a young guy? He like, had the total John Lennon look with the glasses and the little goatee.
I haven't seen a lot of young Billy Joel, but I was watching, like, a very short, like, YouTube clip that he had filmed doing an interview where he kind of plays the piano and answers some British reporters' questions. And I was struck by how much, I don't think of Billy Joel ever as being a young man.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
And he kind of looks like Billy Joe Armstrong, actually, of Green Day, yeah, like back in the day. And it's interesting to think of him in that stage where he's not yet, you know, Billy Joel, the institution. He's just a 28-year-old piano man trying to make it, like, on the same level as some of these other guys, like Elton John. And, like, he talks about being compared to Leon Russell, and it's, you know, Leon Russell had a great career, obviously, but it's crazy to think of Billy Joel being in a spot where he could be envious of,
right,
somebody like Leon
exactly.
Russell's career.
Exactly.
And the Beatles thing is especially interesting to me because the sort of central dilemma of Billy Joel's career, as I've seen, and I think I might be paraphrasing or if not outright stealing from Chuck Klosterman when I say this, but he always struck me as somebody who was naturally McCartney but wanted to be Lennon.
That's interesting.
Like,
yeah.
He's a very natural, like, he's a tunesmith, he's a formalist, he's, you know, a traditionalist almost. I mean, he's a big, you know, Tin Pan Alley fan and Spectre and kind of the classic mold of pop music. And he has these gigantic hits, and he could have had an entire life's worth of, you know, Just the Way You Are and The Longest Times and songs like that. But he also had this really, like, sardonic kind of...
Yeah.
Like a bitterness to him and a desire to be saying more than you know, just these kind of pat love songs. He really wanted to kind of make a difference as well.
Right.
And he thought that was... I don't know if he thought that that's who he was or that's just who he wanted to be. But it was kind of like the warring between those two sides of him that I think makes him so interesting. I mean, does that make sense at all? Is that...
Totally. I mean, I remember reading something where he said, you know, well, A, he took so much critical guff when he was coming up.
Sure.
I mean, I remember reading something about Robert Christgau writing that the better Billy Joel gets, the more obnoxious he becomes.
Probably not totally untrue either, yeah. But yeah.
And he was also like a Golden Gloves boxer. So, you know, there's a little bit of the pugilist in him. Yeah. And then I think, like, there's a quote, and I actually wrote this down, he said, I don't think a love song is effective unless there's an element of anxiety in it and an undercurrent of darkness. And I think that's what makes a lot of his stuff kind of last over the years. And I do think, like, the best love songs have this sort of sense of insecurity and, you know, so.
Well, it's certainly the case with the two love songs in this album, I guess, which were both inspired by, I guess, his real-life wife at the time.
Elizabeth Weber,
yeah. And so he writes Just the Way You Are, which is, you know, it sounds sappy, but as you're saying, it's really not. It's got a very kind of, you know, it's insecure. It's got this undercurrent of... you know, wanting to both assure her and assure himself and wondering like that if this moment's going to last sort of thing. And as it turns out, it doesn't.
Right.
But, you know, who knows if the public cares about all that, because it becomes this monstrous hit and, you know, basically changes his career. But he didn't even want it on the album. He hated the song, and so did the rest of his band. Like, do you know the reason why he ended up putting it on the album? Like, what the swing factor was?
I heard that Phoebe Snow and maybe Linda Ronstadt said, you've got to put it on.
Phoebe Snow and Linda Ronstadt. Very good, yes. Yeah, they're recording in the booth over, and they hear this, you know, this beautiful song with the, you know, the 10cc synths and
right.
This amazing sax solo, and you know, the band, you know, the band's totally nonplussed about it, but they're like, oh, this is a great song, this is a hit, you got to put it on there,
yeah.
You know, and he still kind of dismisses it as, you know, chick music,
right?
But, you know, obviously it connects, it wins a bunch of Grammys. And what do you think of Just the Way You Are?
You know, it's funny, like, there was a period where, I think when I first heard the album, I liked it. Then there was a period where I got sick of it. And now that I've sort of been through my own long-term relationships, I think it's an incredible song, and
sure.
I think it lasts. The funny story I heard, too, about it was that he played this song to Elizabeth Weber on her birthday as a gift.
Ooh, that's risky.
And her response was, do I get the publishing?
Because she was his manager, right?
She was both his wife and his
right,
manager.
Yeah.
And apparently very good at being a manager. Yeah, so.
Oh, and that relationship plays even more into She's Always a Woman, the other kind
right.
of big hit love song off this album, which is really, like, if you look at the lyrics printed out, it is not a particularly complimentary song. And it kind of makes her sound almost like a bad guy. Like, but there's like a respect to it. That
exactly.
It's very, very rare. It's almost like a feminist love song in that he, you know, he's saying, you know, not that she's always a woman and that like she, you know, she's so beautiful. She's so, you know, whatever. She's so magical, but that, you know, she does have these kind of like, you know, masculine traits in that, you know, she has a very business oriented mind and she's very practical. But she's ahead of her time and she's beautiful to me in this specific way. And that's a really kind of powerful sentiment for a song that comes off kind of nasty sometimes.
You know, it's funny. I'm so glad to hear you say that. Cause I'm not a big fan of the sort of, extent to which political correctness has taken hold of our world. And I just think like, this is a completely honest song. I mean,
yeah.
It's so honest and it really is something that's incredibly personal. And that line that you say about, you know, her just being like ahead of her time.
Yeah, like, what other love song
I know.
Would ever have a line like that?
That's
crazy.
Amazing. And you know, so, and I think this, like, you know, the best songs are personal and then they become universal.
Sure.
And I feel like, that's another reason why this song still, to me, like, I love this song way more than Just the Way You Are.
Okay.
I just think it's, if you've been in a really long-term relationship, I think there's a certain amount of gamesmanship that goes on, and you know, this is kind of him saying, hey, you're better than me. You're more than my equal. And I think that that's really cool.
And then there is something to be said for kind of growing into being a Billy Joel fan. And that's probably a large part of why, you know, he still sells out stadiums across the world with people who are, you know, anywhere between the ages of, you know, 20 and 80. Like,
right.
Because you do kind of pick up on different things and you relate to different elements of the lyrics as you grow older. What about the other singles, the other big songs off this album? You know, Moving Out or...
Well, Moving Out, I mean, for me, The Stranger, that's the song that I just remember hearing and listening over and over again.
Moving Out.
I'm sorry, so
The Song of the Stranger.
Yeah, The Song of the Stranger.
Which wasn't even really a single in the U.S.
No. Yeah. But I just remember hearing it and going, oh my God. And, you know, all these years later, one of my favorite albums, and I think one of Bruce Springsteen's best albums is Tunnel of Love. And to me, The Stranger is really
brilliant disguise. Yeah,
like
sure.
20, how many years before that?
A decade, but I could see that certainly. But definitely like a more theatrical than
right, exactly.
Brilliant Disguise. It's got a little bit more of a, you know, like an Andrew Lloyd Webber quality to it almost.
Exactly.
But you know, shout out to Phil Ramone. Like, apparently, the famous, really famous whistling hook on the song, he was, you know, Billy Joel was just whistling it as kind of like a guide track because they were going to lay down a flute or a sax or something to be that part over the kind of the twinkling piano intro. And Phil Ramone says, no, like, that's the song. Like,
yeah.
He's whistling it. And obviously it goes on to be, you know, one of his most famous hooks.
It's such a great thing.
And so, you know, Phil Ramone earns his paycheck, I think, like right then and there with that one piece of advice.
And the same thing with the ack-ack-ack-ack in Moving Out. Like, wasn't that supposed to be just kind of him describing how he wanted something to hear?
Oh, I didn't know that one.
I think
you
Phil
got me on
Ramone
that one.
Said, no, that's on the song.
Oh, those two, like that back-to-back, that deserves like a lifetime's partnership with Billy Joel. I think it's good that they stuck together. Yeah, moving out, I think maybe is my favorite of the big songs of this album. Like, you know, I guess it's the sort of like it sets up a trend that Billy Joel has. Like the first track on his albums is always this kind of like punch you in the chest rocker, and it's
right.
got this kind of like lean guitar and like kind of muscular growl to it. And you actually hear like the guitar, you hear the car revving up at a certain point. The chorus is unbelievable, and that song probably stands up for me as the best. Only The Good Die Young I've never been like a huge fan of, to be honest.
Yeah, I well, as being a Catholic boy, I kind of
okay.
loved it. But and I also like I thought ridiculous that there was sort of an outcry over it.
Yeah, like it got banned like at Seton Hall or something.
Yeah.
It's a very like it's really a pretty innocent song to draw the church's ire. But I think it was just like one or two like really pointed lyrics, I think, that kind of, you know, stuck in the craw of
right
of whoever was in charge of protesting these things. But he says like it made the song blow up, that like the song was kind of floundering, and then there was this, you know, very minor outcry, and now everyone's like flocking to the record stores to get it. He says, you know, ban my records more often.
Yeah. And I remember reading when he was on Saturday Night Live around the time that Stranger came out, and they didn't want him to play that song, and so he played it,
of course.
And
yeah.
I don't remember that performance, but I wish I'd hope that I can go back and see it.
Yeah, have you ever heard the reggae version of the song?
No.
So like, apparently the story behind this is that like Billy Joel imagined the song as a reggae song. His drummer Liberty DeVito hates reggae. I think it's Liberty DeVito. Apologies,
yes,
Liberty DeVito. If it's somebody else in his band, I apologize. Okay. But I think it's Liberty DeVito. And he says fine. So they kind of compromise on this sort of shuffle kind of swing thing. And but there exists like an alternate take on one of his box sets that you get to hear the song in its kind of original reggae incarnation.
Oh my God.
I actually think it's pretty cool.
So you've heard it.
I was listening to it on YouTube earlier. The verses work pretty well. The chorus is kind of flat.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have like those saxes that are kind of like buoyant and kind of carry the song's melody through. But only like the fourth biggest single off the album. It's only The Good Die Young. That song's held up pretty well for a lot of people. I know my friends, like my Long Island friends, who, you know, for Billy Joel's, you know, he's a religious icon, basically. Like that's one of these songs, is Only The Good Die Young.
Yeah.
But another thing about this album that's just so incredible is that, you know, we talk about all these singles, but like the deep cuts on this album are more famous than, you know, 90% of other album
right.
singles. Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, maybe like one of his, you know, five or ten most famous songs. Is that one of your Billy Joel favorites?
Oh my God, I love it, and it's for me, what is that? Is that movie Francis Ford Coppola, Peggy Sue?
Peggy Sue, right,
sure. It's the that's the song version of that movie. It's like this incredible, the sense of like, you know, who you are in high school changes as you get older,
mm-hmm.
and what you think is really smart to do now is not smart 5 years from now. And it just totally captured that to me again, that sort of middle class strivers world that was, you know, I think as the 80s came and yuppiedom advanced, was sort of let go.
Yeah. And I wonder if, like, formally it's his entry into sort of that like burgeoning like multi-part rock epic like FM standard thing, like, you know, it's his Bohemian Rhapsody or his Jungle Land, or,
right?
It's like everyone had to have one, and this was his, like, okay, I'll be playing the song in encores for the rest of my life after this.
Well, I remember reading too that he said he was inspired by some of the songs on Abbey Road, I think.
Okay,
that he liked the way that the Beatles worked in these fragmentary things where songs would kind of go in and out. And that's inspired by that's the sort of the way he originally was, just like Brenda and Eddie, and then he started putting these other parts onto it.
Okay. And so I was reading a New York Times interview of him from like 2008, I think. And the guy asks, you know, he's complaining about all of his old hit songs and about how he doesn't like any of them anymore. And the guy says, well, okay, what were the ones you actually got right? And he names two songs, and one of them's on this album. Can you guess which one it is?
Well, I'm gonna, since, can I get a hint? Is it anything we've discussed yet?
It's not something we've discussed yet, no.
So it's either Vienna or Everybody Has a Dream.
It's Vienna. I'll give you that much. Yeah, it's Vienna. And like, I remember the last time I saw him, when I saw him at the Nassau Coliseum show, he asked the crowd, he's like, okay, you guys get to call this one. He says, I got one song that was a big hit, and one song was an album track. It's Just the Way You Are, or Vienna. Which one do you want to hear? And he kind of, you know, he does the applause-o-meter thing,
right,
informally. And he kind of projected that he wanted the crowd to lead towards Vienna, but to the crowd's credit, man, they went for it. Like, the Vienna won hook, line, and sinker over Just the Way You Are. And I think that it's a sort of litmus test between like the big Billy Joel fans and the casual Billy
right,
Joel fans.
Exactly.
I think if you love Vienna, then that means that you're really part of the cult.
I do. I mean, are you a fan of it?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't consider it one of my favorites of his, but it's definitely like an definitive Billy Joel song, I would say.
I read too that, like, I guess that's where his dad moved at one point in his life, and
yeah.
So and he was there visiting him, and he saw a 90-year-old woman working in the street, and he said, like, what's she doing? He said, well, you know, here people work very late in life, and he said, like, oh, wow, so this could be a place where I can come and be appreciated when I'm older.
Now, I'll say, if you don't know that backstory, the line, when will you realize that Vienna waits for you, makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it clearly struck a chord, and it's one of the few songs that he seems to still have appreciation for within his back catalog.
I love that song. And I love Everybody Has a Dream, too. That's to me like him doing Ray Charles.
Yeah, it kind of sounds more like Randy Newman to me. Like, I'm not feeling.
You don't feel
Everybody
that
Has a Dream. Now, I will say that Get It Right the First Time, which is sort of the other, like you know, if you're doing like the bar trivia, like name all the tracks on The Stranger,
right?
You get the first seven, I think, probably pretty easily, and then the last two, you got to really know the album to know the album. But Get It Right the First Time, I think, is actually a really great song.
Wow, we disagree on that.
Really? Okay.
Go ahead.
I like the opening, like, little drum shuffle thing.
Little,
like, it's like a, yeah. Like, I think it could be sampled for a hip hop break like 20 years later.
That, yeah, well, that's true.
Well. I like the little flute hook, and I think it's a good chorus. It's a very, very strong chorus to me. But Everybody Has a Dream, it kind of, you know, sounds pandering to me. It's very kind of lightweight gospel. Not his forte,
true.
But I do like that the album ends with a kind of the return of the Stranger whistling motif.
Right.
And I think it's almost like a proud 70s tradition of these classic rock albums that are just so front-loaded that by the time you get to the end of them, like can you say what the last track on Hotel California is? Like,
no.
Exactly. Like, so they put all the hits up first. So I think
right.
It's a sign of the times in that respect. But yeah, I mean, like for you know, I wonder about this album's legacy to a certain extent, because so much of it has been co-opted by radio, and so much of it is on the, like, if you own the greatest hits, if you own like Billy Joel's Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2, which sold a combined, whatever, 25 million copies, and pretty much everybody I know, either they have it or their parents have it, or they grew up listening to it, basically.
Right.
And you have all these songs. There's no reason to go back and investigate The Stranger, because like this is basically Greatest Hits Volume 1 is The Stranger.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, like, if people, like, you know, Billy Joel fans growing up now, like, do they even care about this album? Do they even care about Billy Joel albums, period? Or is it all just the hits?
That's a good question. I mean, I as someone who remains in the minority of liking albums and the way albums roll mm-hmm. out and sort of tell a story. I mean, I think this is one of those that is worth revisiting because, you know, I don't know what the sequence is on the greatest hits, whether mm-hmm. they do, but this thing unfolds in a way that I think really works as an album in a way that today a lot of, you know, well, we both know it's all about the singles now.
Sure, yeah. And we touched on this before, but obviously another thing hurting the album is that, you know, Billy Joel's never really gotten the critical respect that, you know, I think most people would say at this point that he deserved, but certainly never that was commiserate with his commercial success at the time.
Right.
And like, what do you think it is, if you can kind of like pinpoint to one thing that separated him from somebody like Bruce Springsteen? Is it just like the kind of theatricality of it, or the fact that you can see him, you know, trying a little bit more than, you know, Bruce has kind of more of a natural sort of vibe to him? Like, what is it that made Billy Joel such critical anathema to his, well, his peers?
It's interesting because I think it had to do with the times. I mean, I saw Billy Joel live before I saw Bruce Springsteen live, mm-hmm. and I just remember coming out of that show just being like, on fire. It was such an amazing live act, and he's, you know, and you know, he, you know, it's funny for a bald guy, he had hair then. He had hair, he's dressed up, the band was really hot, mm-hmm. and he just really put on an amazing performance. I think he started kind of getting his great success as the music world was changing. We were getting punk mm-hmm. and the sort of new wavy stuff, and then, and, you know, the New York, look at the New York music scene as, you know, Talking Heads and sure. all these things. And so there's that. And meanwhile, even in the heyday of Springsteen and all the other people that were going on at that time, like, he's got this sort of component to him that is like Great American Songbook that I think is really just never fit anywhere except that with the Great American Songbook. So I think it's one of the reasons why he's lasted so long, but it's also one of the reasons why people just didn't know what to do with him,
mm-hmm.
you know, so... I'd love to know what you think.
Well, no, I think I do agree with that. I think that actually, you know, he and Springsteen probably had more in common than people realized at the time. Yes, you know, Springsteen, I think there was a sort of like, you know, poeticism to his early lyrics that kind of got him the benefit of the doubt as he got older and more commercial.
Yeah.
Like, certainly, like, Born in the USA is as commercial as anything. That
exactly.
And, you know, and Bruce Springsteen wrote some preposterous lyrics himself that, you know, and he was certainly not devoid of pretension. So there's more of a crossover there than people probably gave him credit for. But there is something to the idea that Billy Joel was always a very self-conscious performer, a very self-conscious songwriter, and just as much in the pop world as of the rock world, which I think, moving forward is going to be a good thing for his longevity.
Yeah.
Now that, you know, the kind of traditional arguments about rock credibility have sort of fallen by the wayside. Like, I was reading... like an old interview from Billy Joel's from 15 years ago, and it mentions Robert Christgau again. And he says, oh, it'll never happen. Like, he's never going to get the critical respect that he wants because it's just not good enough, is what he says. And I think if that's the reason, then that's just not true. Like, there has to be a more fundamental reason for why critics didn't like Billy Joel. And I think that whatever that reason was, it's fallen by the wayside with every decade to come. Now, I don't know if he's going to be included in greatest album of all time type lists, but the songs have certainly held up.
Yeah.
And I think that my generation and generations to come are, you know, they're going to be so far removed from whatever kind of politics played into his critical reputation in the 70s and 80s that they're just going to appreciate the songs. And they'll exist forever, basically, as just great songs. And no one will care whether he was cool or not, how hard he was trying. They'll just know that, you know, they've been passed down from generation to generation, and they still sound pretty good today.
Yeah.
But speaking of that, would you have any interest in a Billy Joel album in 2017, like a new Billy Joel album?
I would love to hear what he would do. I mean, like, the one thing I think that he does do really well is this sort of kind of honesty.
Yeah.
Not the song necessarily, but this sort of... real, I mean, you know, just in those the songs we were talking about, you know, there's a real sort of he really puts it on the page and on the song, and mm-hmm. I'd love to hear. I mean, I'm just really surprised that he hasn't done anything new. It's just crazy. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, especially when, you know, he says he can't really find a way into contemporary music, but he never sounded. I mean, at least looking back, it never seemed like he cared that much about being contemporary.
Right.
You know, when he does An Innocent Man, that's his doo-wop throwback album in 1983. I mean,
exactly.
Certainly, I don't know what he was trying to have a dialogue with in modern music then, But, you know, I guess he is older and he knows that he can't kind of speak to the kids the way he once did. But I would love to hear Billy Joel's, like, Time Out of Mind. Like, why can't you have, like, a very old, very honest Billy Joel album about, you know, his life of regrets and, you know, kind of facing the final act and like, that would be captivating. That would be fascinating, I think.
I agree. Now, have you ever heard his classical album?
No. I'm not sure what there is to glean from Billy Joel from the classical album. Have you?
No, I've not.
I do feel like as a fan, I sort of owe it to him. Like, clearly this is something that was a passion project of his. And, you know, if he felt personally invested enough to make it, you know, he should probably give it a chance. But, yeah, it's just hard to kind of reconcile that with the Billy Joel the songs that we know and love. But
I agree.
Well, hopefully if he does come back in 2017, it will be with, you know, the pop vocals. And I would love to hear it.
That would be fantastic. Right. I would do it.
Frank DiGiacomo, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thank you. It was a blast.
Yeah.
Take care.
Good time.